Hello, is this Mr. Oldis?
Yes.
Hi, this is Steve Jeremko.
Yeah, Steve, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, thank you. Is it a good time for you to do an interview?
Oh, why not? Hell yes, I don't know what the hell you're going to learn, but you're a good time to do an interview. It's beautiful. Where are you at, Steve?
Well, I'm in, do you know where Binghamton, New York is? Yep, I live just outside of Binghamton. It's a small town called Vestal.
Oh, okay. Good.
And I live with Lindy, and she's here with me. She's listening in.
Oh, my God. So you can't use no baseball slang or anything like that, huh?
I didn't realize they use foul language in baseball.
Once in a while, maybe the Yankees are...
You
know, few words right now after getting beat yesterday, yes.
Oh, boy. Hey, before we get started, are you paying attention to the championship series?
Yeah. I nothing else to do when you're retired and everything else. Steve, you got a TV bill comes once a month, so I all those other days I watch TV, yeah.
Well, you know, it's really great to see Washington back in
the, yeah.
That felt really good.
I broke in with them.
I know.
I think Mickey Vernon won the batting championship, and he asked for a raise. This is 1952 or 3. He asked for a raise, and Clark Griffin told him, we finished last with you, and we could finish last without you. You're not going to get a raise, but he finally got $1,000 out of him anyhow.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about Mickey Vernon later on. He was one of the greats, really.
He was one of the really nicest guys. Him and his wife, Lib, were unbelievable people, yes.
Well, I have an introduction to read, and then we can get started, okay?
Okay, whatever you fire at me, I'll try to answer, or we'll figure a way through it anyhow.
Okay, very good. Would you like me to call you Mr. Oldis, or do you prefer Bob or Robert? Or
Bob, B-O-B, spelled backwards.
Okay, great. So I'm going to clear my throat and get ready. All right. Today is October 16, 2019, and on behalf of SABRE, the Society of American Baseball Research, we are interviewing Mr. Bob Oldis for our oral history project. My name is Steve Jeremko, and I'm talking on the phone with Mr. Oldis, who is at his home in Arizona. Mr. Oldis was a catcher who played 15 years in professional baseball. He began his major league career with the Washington Senators in 1953 and joined the Pittsburgh Pirates in 1960 before finishing his playing career with the Philadelphia Phillies in 1963. Mr. Oldis was a team member of the world champion Pittsburgh Pirates and appeared in two games of that series against the New York Yankees. Following his playing career, Bob was a coach for the Phillies from 64 to 66, the Minnesota Twins in 68, the Montreal Expos in their first year in 1969, and then he also scouted for the Phillies and the Expos. He has been associated with the Florida Marlins since 2002, or should I say the Miami Marlins. Now let's hear his... What?
Yeah, either one. It used to be Florida, and then it got so small it moved it to Miami.
Yeah. So anyway, you've been with the Marlins since 2002. So welcome, Bob Oldis, to the SABRE Oral History Project. Let's hear your story.
Well, okay. Steve, we're surviving, and I can't wait till next year around the middle of June. I guess the Pirates are going to invite us, the ball club of 1960, back for their, what would it be, 60 years? Anniversary, so I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. I'd love to come and see whatever I could catch. would be wonderful. I'm from Pittsburgh originally.
Well, it was a great town until they got rid of me. Until they got rid of me, the trading deadline on June 15th of 61, a year after we won it. I mean, the guys won it. I was just, I just followed them. I just followed them around, showed them where the ballpark was. I was one of the fortunate 25 guys that was there all year.
Well, we were sure glad to have you there. And I got to tell you, it's an honor to have you talk to us on for this project. So anyway, what I wanted to start with, we have some formal questions. So what was your given name at birth?
When I was a kid, it was only Bob or Ole. But then after I got to the big leagues, I broke in with the Washington Senators. My first manager was Bucky Harris. And finally, I got sort of a nickname, Bucky, after that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, how about that? Where and where? When were you born?
I was born January 5, 1928, a couple days ago, and still surviving.
Well, that's the same year my father was born.
Great. It was a good year. I thought my mom and dad did a good job picking that year out too.
Well, tell us a little bit about them. What were their names and what did they do?
My dad, he was a postmaster in Preston, Iowa, starts with a P, a town of 596 people. And after the new president came in, somehow he lost his job. And so we moved to Iowa City, Iowa, the home of the Hawkeyes, and I been a resident of Iowa City every year since then.
What was your dad's name?
Ed.
And how about your mother?
Emma.
And was she a homemaker or did she work outside the home?
She was a homemaker and she's a darn good cook, I'll tell you that.
Did you have siblings?
Yes, I had an older brother who's still living and lives in Chicago by the name of Edward. And when he graduated from high school in 1942, he enlisted into the Navy. He was going to make the Navy a lifetime job. And I think it was 42. Might have been, as soon as he came out of high school, might have been 39 or 40. But as soon as he got out of high school, he enlisted in the Navy, and he was in Bremerton, Washington, where they made aircraft ships on Pearl Harbor Day. And 2 days later, he was heading for Pearl Harbor.
Wow.
So, and then I have a sister who passed away about 2 years ago, younger than me, and she was a good girl. She was a good sister, I know that. And then I had a younger brother who passed away about 4 years ago, and he was younger than me. But my older brother, who's 96, I think now, 97, still kicking around in Chicago. And I'm his brother, or the only two left going.
Oh. Well, would you say that you grew up mostly in Preston, or was it Iowa City that you were?
Iowa City. We moved there when I was about 4 years old.
Oh, okay. And what was that community like? Was it, how did you, you know, tell us about your introduction into sports?
Well, my brother, when we got to Iowa City, my brother was 5 years older than me, or 6 years older than I was. And I followed him around, and he was he always wanted to be the leader, so he always had a baseball team, and he always took me Legion Ball or town team or anything like that. He always took me along, and I was the youngest guy on the team. He had guys his age playing, but he always took me along, and I played with guys that was older than I was all my life when I was a kid. And yeah, I know that made me better by playing with people better than you. You get better, and people older, you learn things. And he really helped me in my baseball career.
Oh yeah.
And then in 48, my dad says, "You know, Bob, you're a pretty good player." There wasn't many scouts around in the Midwest, and so he says, "I'm going to send you to Cocoa, Florida, to a Jack Rossiter baseball school for 5 weeks. I want you to go down there and show them what you can do and maybe learn something." And so I got on a bus from Iowa City, Iowa, went to Cocoa, Florida, 4 nights and 3 days, changing buses and getting there and everything. After the third week, there was about 190 of us in that camp in 1949 in January. And when I got the camp, there was about 190 of us in that camp. Paid $25 a week, my dad paid. That's $125. That was a lot of money then, back then.
Yeah.
And after the third week, Jack Rossiter called me and he says, "We want to sign you to a pro baseball contract."
Wow.
I said, "Okay." So I signed the thing. I called my dad up. I said, "I'm coming home, Dad. After 3 weeks down here, I already signed the contract." He says, "You stay there for 2 more weeks. Maybe you'll learn something." So I stayed there. Jack Rossiter let me stay for the other 2 weeks. And some of the coaches that Jack Rossiter had then was Andy Semenik, Pete Appleton, an old-time pitcher, Cecil Travis. That's about the only people I can remember. But he had some good instructors and evaluation. So 9 of us got signed out of that camp, and I was the only one still surviving. I guess the other ones must have died on him or something. But anyhow, I was the only one that came out of that camp to sign.
Oh, that's great. So you didn't have it wasn't a bonus baby kind of arrangement then?
The bonus was get the hell in to Emporia, Virginia, Class D ball. That's where you're going to have spring training, right at the town of Emporia, Virginia. Back then it was about, I don't know, 2,000, maybe 4,000 people. And Howie Fox, who was the general manager then, who became executive for the Minnesota Twins later on, but he was a good friend of Clark Griffin. He was the general manager, and that's how I got started.
Oh, that's great. So you spent 2 years with Emporia Blue Jackets.
My first year, 1949, we had a catcher by the name of Orlando Echeverrian, a Cuban catcher. They said in 1952, he will be playing in the big leagues. It was a hot day in July. First part of July, I can remember. And he comes to the ballpark. He says, me don't feel good today. Me sick." And he had broken Cuban accent. And so he says, you sit up the stands or go home, whatever you want to do. Bob will catch both games at the doubleheader." So that day, that Sunday afternoon, in the second inning, as usual, I was batting 8. I was such a good hitter. I was batting 8, and I hit 2 home runs in 1 inning.
Wow!
And so in the 4th inning, Orlando Echeverry shows up in the clubhouse. He He says, Dee, we feel better now. I'll play the second game. And from that day on, I caught pretty much the rest of the season. And that's how I got started. I got a break. I had a good bat that wasn't cracked or anything. Helped me out, hit two home runs. And I think I hit five for the whole year.
You did. You hit five, and you batted .285. So you had a pretty good year at bat.
Yeah, that's how I got a break. I was lucky enough to take advantage of it, and that's how I really got started. Then the next year we came back to Emporia again, and as you know, I jumped from D to B, and I was lucky enough to get to the big leagues for a little while.
Well, you said that Emporia had maybe 2,500 people. So when you would go to, we'd have games, how many people would attend typically?
Well, there'd be 1,000 people or so. Yeah, the town showed up pretty good there, yeah.
Oh, that's good.
They really did, yeah. Uh-huh. And
Well, I'll tell you what, Bob, from our experience, we live in Binghamton, and we got the Binghamton Rumble Ponies here. And
yep.
Those minor league games are a lot of fun, I'll tell you. I really enjoy them. Okay, so then in 51, you spent 49 and 50 with Emporia, and then you got bumped up to the Charlotte Hornets in the Tri-State League. And again, you had a pretty good year at bat there, .285.
Yeah, I played every day there. We were the only club in baseball in 1951 that won 100 games that year. We won 100 and lost 40. And we won the pennant by 15 games or so. And we had a good ball club. Yes, we did.
Any of your teammates that you recall from that time, or who was managing the club?
Cal Ermer was our manager. E-R-M-E-R, Cal Ermer. Yep,
Cal Ermer. He managed the Twins later on.
That's right. And he's really a fine gentleman. And he managed that ball club. And the following year, he went to Chattanooga to manage a double-A club for Washington.
Uh-huh.
And I was assigned to go to spring training in Chattanooga. And after having a good year the year before, and I can remember during spring training, I wasn't playing very much. And I told Cal, Cal, I want to play. I want to make this ball club. He says, Bob, just take your time. He says, the big leagues are your goal. And so I said, yeah, but I want to make this ball club this year. And finally, about 2 weeks later, he called me in the office. He says, Bob, we was good friends then. And then he says, Bob, I'm going to have to send you back to Charlotte. I says, no, Cal, you must be kidding me. And he says, yes. He says, pack your stuff. You're going to the big leagues during spring training.
Uh-huh.
And so I went to the big league club in Orlando, Florida, with the big club. And Bucky Harris, the manager, and Mickey Grosso and Clyde Kluss was the two other catchers. And that's how it all happened. Yep. I was very lucky.
So that when you first hit the Senators, I have some names here for some of the other players that were on there, and anything you could tell us about it would be great. There was a catcher, Ed Fitzgerald. I know he was.
Eddie Fitzgerald. I think he was there at 52. I think we picked him up later. I'm not sure where Eddie started at Washington. I played with Eddie though, because I spent so many years at Washington, Chattanooga. It was 54, I spent all year there. 55, 56. I was up and down from Chattanooga to Washington so many times they should have let me buy a train ticket back then.
Do you recall Jackie Jensen being on the team at that time?
Oh, yes. I was with us when we traded Jim Busby to Washington. And, yeah, I can remember Jackie Jensen because being from Iowa, he married a girl from Iowa, a great swimmer, a diver, what was it, Olson? So that was her first name. I forget now. Anyhow, yes, he was some kind of an athlete.
Yeah, you know, the only thing about him that I remember reading was he had an aversion to air flight. And it kind of curtailed his career a little bit toward the end.
Yeah, if he could have played 10 years earlier when they traveled only by train, he would have loved it. Yeah, but he didn't like flying.
So tell us a little bit about Mickey Vernon. You mentioned him earlier, and I know he's one of my favorite players.
He's the first guy I believe I ever met, first guy in the big leagues that came up to congratulated me and everything else. Him and his wife, Lip, we became close friends. That later on, I left the Washington organization, and as you know, Mickey Vernon and Danny Murtaugh were very good friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got to Pittsburgh, who's my first base coach is Mickey Vernon. So it all came back to be really a good enjoyment.
Yeah, he was also the first manager of the new Washington Senators.
He sure was. 61. He was really a true gentleman. If every person was like Mickey Vernon was, there'd be no worries in the world. I know that.
Pete Runnels.
Pete Runnels, well, from Houston, Texas. He was a good hitter, and I don't know if it should. It's just kind of a funny story, but it's I don't know if I should tell you or not. But anyhow, can I tell you?
Is it a good one? I'd love to hear it. You're a good storyteller.
If you can't put it on the air or in the paper or anything, you can scratch it out, can't you?
Oh, sure.
Oh, okay. Well, Pete was our shortstop in Washington, and he was a good hitter and played. And back then, you know, we didn't have steel cups. They was made out of plastic.
Mm-hmm.
And Pete went to field a ground ball and took a bad hop and hit him in the wrong spot. And he's laying there, and here comes Doc Lentz, our trainer, out. And old Doc Lentz, I don't know if you knew him or not, but he was a funny guy. We didn't have zippers on our pants like they do now. They have buttons.
Yeah.
So he's laying on his back, and he's pulling him up and down and up and down. And finally, they unbuttoned his pants, and his plastic cup hit him, and there was a crack in it, and one of his testicles was caught in the crack.
Oh my gosh!
But he was lifting him up and down, and it was funner than hell. Now,
well,
but, next 2-3 days, he was walking around like he was full legged or something. I'll never forget that incident.
Well, he still managed to hit 300 after that. So.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he was a good hitter. Yeah, really a good guy. Eddie Yost.
Yeah, Eddie Yost. Yeah, he's on my list. Yeah.
Oh, he's one of the all-time great third basemen of all time. He would play every day. I was there. I come to think about it, after Eddie Yost got hit and got hurt, he had a consecutive game streak going for a long time back then. He had, they wanted to keep it going, and they listed me as an infielder for Eddie Yost to take the field when we were at home.
Yeah.
And then, I forget how it all worked out now, but I can remember replacing him once or twice in the lineup. And then Eddie Yost, by taking his place, sort of keep the streak going. But He was a tough player, boy. He was one of the best all-time leadoff hitters I've ever seen.
Well, they called him the walking man because he was so good at getting on, you know, and he...
Yeah, he could really do that. He was a great leadoff hitter, yeah.
You know, I noticed you did pretty good. Your walks to strikeout ratio was really good.
Well, the pitcher was scared of me. The face is empty or something, so they figured that we just won't walk you. What the hell?
Got a couple more names from that team. Chuck Staubs.
Chuck Staubs. I had the honor of being Griffith Stadium the day Mickey Mantle hit that 565-footer in Griffith Stadium, completely out of Griffith Stadium. I had a good view of that. If you remember Griffith Stadium, the home bullpen was in right center. Chuck Staubs is pitching. Mantle hit that ball, and we was out in deep right center. And when the ball got up above the stands, it looked like somebody hit it again. It took off further, and we had a good view of that. I had a good, very good shot of that 565-footer that Chuck Staubs had the right chance to ride on.
Yeah.
So what was do you recall what his attitude was about giving up that tape measure home run?
No, he never. I don't think it bothered him a bit. I don't think it bothered him. He was really that good guy. He was funnier than hell and really a nice guy. I don't think he was buried back then, and I don't think he ever went with any girls or anything like that, or even looked at them. But he was a good pitcher. He was a good left-handed pitcher, and I enjoyed Chuck Staubs.
Bob Porterfield.
Bob Porterfield. He had good stuff. He had really good stuff. He had a good fastball that really moved and an outstanding curveball. He was a tough competitor, and I think if he could have been on a better ball club, he would have won a lot more games.
Yeah, he had a pretty good year, 1 year for the Senators. I know he won it 20
games.
Yes, he
sure did. Mm-hmm.
Wayne Terwilliger.
The Twig. He could play second base as good as anybody around. He was really a fancy dad around there. His bat was they walked me so many times, they wouldn't walk Twig. He played every day, and he was a good second baseman, defensive second baseman, and he knew how to play the game. He was very good. And then later on, he became manager of the Twins, didn't he? Yeah. Didn't he become manager of the Minnesota Twins later on?
So that was in 50. So that was 53, and so you had you didn't do too bad batting 250, and then you went to Chattanooga then for the rest of the season.
Yeah, I went to Chattanooga to help Cal over out again. So Cal needed somebody to talk to, I guess. So he asked me to get it back. I went for about, what was it, $4,500 or $5,000 a year to $450 a month. So I took a pay cut just to come back to the town.
I hope it was worth it. then you went back up to the Senators again in 54.
Yeah, 54. That was a year that not many people know it, but I hit .333 that year.
You did.
24.
You sure did.
I didn't tell them how many times I went to play or anything like that, but I hit .333. I stayed with them all year, and enjoyable, yes.
Now, that year, they added some new faces that became pretty good players, and if you could tell us a little bit about them. Harmon Killebrew?
He came off the high school out of Idaho, the state of Idaho. I think he joined us in Chicago. God damn, when he took batting practice, he could hit balls higher than anybody I ever saw. It just showed you there that he had power. As soon as he gets that timing down, he was going to hit a lot of home runs.
And he wasn't all that big of a guy, was he?
He's only about 5'10 or 11, but strong as heck, and couldn't run a lick. And so he had great power. He really was. And guys you would ever want to meet in your life. He was some kind of a super gentleman.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I always admired him as a player. Jim Lemon.
Jim Lemon. Big Lemon. We played together in Chattanooga a little bit, and he was a big, strong, right-handed hitter. When he made contact, he hit it good. But he didn't make much contact sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
But I liked him. He was a good boy.
He was one of the early managers of the new Washington Senators in the early 60s.
That's right.
Yeah. Camilo Pasquale.
Oh, boy, what a curveball he had. He had the best curveball. Compared to with Koufax, he had that kind of a curveball, straight downer. And it was a tough one, and he had good control. He knew how to pitch too. He was a good pitcher. He was one of the better pitchers around back then.
Hmm. And Roy Sievers.
Roy Sievers, the guy from St. Louis, I know really well, and I haven't seen him for a long time. And he could swing that bat. He had the best swing of any hitter you ever wanted to see. He swung so easy, and the ball just jumped off his bat. And he could play first base. He was really an all-star player.
Yeah, because the Senators at that time, boy, they had Killebrew, Lemon, and Sievers. That was quite they had quite a lot of power. Well, Harmon was just getting started then, but.
Yeah, that's right.
So, let's see now, in 55, you were there for part of the season.
Yeah, probably June, they got tired of me sitting on the bench. They thought it was some dummy over there. But yeah, I, 55, is that the year? Charlie Dresden took over, I think, 55 or 56. 56, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie and me didn't get along very good. He didn't like me. He couldn't. When I went out in 56, my last year, right out of options, he sent me as far away as he could. He sent me back to Charlotte, the major leagues, the Class B ball. And then I raised so much heck. I went to Charlotte, played a couple of weeks, and then Cal Irmer, who was still managing it at Chattanooga, he finally got a chance to get a hold of me, at least move me up to Double A ball.
Well, was he still lonely?
Pardon?
Was he still lonely?
Yeah, he was still lonely. Cal was heck yes. He wanted to know what happened to me, and I was happy to get back to chat to them.
Well, tell me a little bit about Charlie Dresden. What was the issue there? Was it just a personality clash, do you think, or was there a...
Everything was me. I did this, I did that, I did this. When a lot of games, we'll have meals and everything else in here. He had meals only for the press. To show the press that he could entertain them. We never got any of that food. But Charlie, I can remember his first day. What was his first year there? 55, 56?
Let me look. I heard he's in 55. Let me check in 54. Bucky Harris was 54, so Chuck Dressen came in 55.
Yeah, I can remember opening day in 1955. I know what it was now. 55 was opening day in Washington, and our catcher, Courtney, got on base, and they put Pedro Ramos in the run for Courtney at first base.
Yeah.
And somebody got a base hit. Ramos could run like heck. God, darn, he could run. He was faster than Dickens. And he got the third base on a base hit. Charlie Dressen, this is opening day now in 55. And he called timeout. Oldest. Yeah, Jesus Christ, they woke me up. And you come in here, you're going to pinch run for Raymond. I was a pinch runner for a pinch runner on opening day. And that's how I got in one of the games that year. Yeah. But I was used as a pinch runner for a pinch runner. And I couldn't run very fast. And Ramos could outrun horses and everything else. He could fly.
Wow. And he was a pitcher. In fact, I wanted to ask you about him. What kind of character was he like?
Very quiet and great. He had good he could throw. And I can remember a story with Raymond. Well, it reminds me of Raymond. In our first trip into Boston that year, 55, I can remember very well. In Boston, you had to come out of the first base dugout to go across the field to the third base dugout. The visiting dugout was on the third base side, Midway Park. And I was going across the field, and the Red Sox was taking batting practice. And this big guy, number 9, says, hey, Bob, welcome to the big league. Hope you stay here a long time. I figured it out a little bit. I said, I'm talking to Ken Williams. I'm just walking across, going to my dugout. After a while, he says, hey, Bob, I just want to welcome you here and everything. I want you to have a good time and everything. He says, by the way, Bob, you got a pitcher by the name of Ramos. I says, yeah. What's he so? I says, he's got a fastball. And he had a curveball, what we call a slider nowadays, a quick breaking slider. And how's his control? I said, oh, he's got good control. And everything else, he says, does he have a changeup? I said, no, he's trying to learn a changeup, but he hasn't got one yet. And so after the conversation is over with, Ted says, well, good luck. And over in the corner of the dugout, waiting for me, is Mickey Vernon and Eddie Yost. Come here, Bob. We want to ask you something. What's that big donkey want? referring to Ken Williams. He just welcomed me to the big league. Hope I stay a long time and all that. Oh, he did ask me about Ramos, because he's the only rookie pitcher we had that year. And, Eddie Yost says to Mickey Vernon, see, he knows more about Ramos than we do. So he knew if he ever faced Ramos, he knew what the heck to expect and all that. So I was good to a lot of people. But I was a bad loser.
You mentioned Courtney. Can you tell us a little bit about Clint Courtney? They called him Scrap Iron, I believe.
Scrap Iron. Oh, he had a. He'd fight anybody. He'd fight the umpire. He had over a ball strike. He argued everything else. He was a tough competitor, and he played hard. He really played hard, and he was fun to be around.
Yeah.
He was a good guy, though. He was, God darn, he was one of the first catchers
Yeah, one of the first, yeah. I think so. Yeah.
And they wasn't thick glasses either.
Yeah.
They kind of thick.
Mm-hmm. Well, you played for, I was going to, when we get to the Phillies, I wanted to ask about Ryan Duren, because he wore thick glasses too, so.
I was Ryan Duren in 57 in Denver. Ralph Houck was a manager who became a Yankee manager later.
Mm-hmm.
One of the really true gentlemen in the world. But anyhow, Ryan Duren, he joined us. We got him, I think, from Kansas City in a trade. The Yankees did. They sent him to Denver. And God thought he could throw hard. But God only knew where it was going to go. He wore about 8 different color glasses. Light blue, clear, darker, orange, and all this. He's the only guy that I ever played with. He wore glasses sometimes to take a shower. But he knew he couldn't throw. I couldn't see. And then he got a bat against him. And when he throws that hard, a lot of hitters didn't like that. And he'd look in there. And I wonder if he even looked at the sign. Because he could throw hard. And he was a funny guy. He was really funny. But I enjoyed him very much.
Yeah.
He was a championship club in Denver that year with us. Yeah.
So you went to the Chattanooga Lookouts again and then the Charlotte Hornets again in 55.
Yeah.
And what was that experience?
Charlie sent me, 55 was that?
Yeah, 55, yeah.
Dressing. Yeah, 55, so Charlie dressed to me. The Class B ball that Cal Irmer got a hold of me, and I got to Chattanooga with Cal. I didn't play that many games in Charlotte, I don't think, but we got to be friends again, and I made him happy. He made me happy, I was just accidentally sent down as far as I could. Charlie wanted to bury me, but kicking it, and I got out of that basement and just went up a little higher.
Oh, no, I don't think that set you back too much, the way your career went. So in 56, you were with the Lookouts again, and that was that was Cal Irmer then, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then in 57, looks like the Senators, what did they do, sell your contract to the Yankees?
Yeah, they sold me to the Yankees, and I went over with the Yankees and organization, and Ralph Houck was the manager, John Blanchard, and myself was the two catchers at Denver, and we won it all, the Little World Series and everything. We beat, I think, Buffalo in the Little World Series, and then in 58, we divided pretty much catching him and me in 57 in Denver. And he was a great left-handed hitter. And he could swing that bat. And then in 58, they said, we're going to split you up. Excuse me. going to split you up. Back then, the Yankees had 2 AAA clubs. With Washington, they had no AAA clubs. And only a double-A. The Yankees had triple-A clubs.
Yeah.
They sent me to Richmond, Virginia to play in the International League under Eddie Lopat.
Right.
The left-handed pitcher. And Blanchard stayed in Denver. And then in 59, I went back to Denver. Blanchard went to the big leagues. And then that winter, I got drafted in the winter draft by the Pirates. Howie Haig in the Pirates, yeah.
Howie Haig, yeah, he was the scout, yeah.
Old time scout, yeah.
Yeah, but some of the guys you played with on the Yankee farm clubs, you had Marv Fronberry was there, Norm Seaburn, and.
Norm Seaburn, he was a good center fielder. He could play. Marv Fronberry. he could ever take Mickey Mantle to the team running wise when he hit a home run. When he hit him, it was going to go. And we had a good ball club that year.
Yeah, Tom Lasorda was one of your teammates that year too, or one of those.
While,
yeah.
People tell you. And Tom and me, we'll run across each other. I haven't seen him for about 5 years. But Lasorda, since he's been a Dodger Blue all his life, people forgot he spent about a half a year or so in the Yankee organization.
So, getting up to 1960, when you went to the Pirates, that was you found yourself on a world championship club, and to me, that the Pirates had a really fascinating team, and I thought if you could just tell us about your recollections of some of the folks on that team and the players that you played with.
My talent yet. We had Smokey Burgess, who could swing the bat with anybody. He says, if you need a base hit, he was a left-handed hitter, just hit the ball to left field. You need the long ball, turn your belly button, and pull the ball over the right field fence. and Smokey didn't like to catch too much. He only liked guys like Haddix and Law. If he was a catcher, catching either one of those two guys, you could turn your head and talk and look at the umpire and talk to him and never move your glove. The ball will go right in your glove. And he loved those guys who had great control. He didn't like catching Bob Fred because Fred had that mean curveball that he threw in the dirt a lot. But God darn, when you come to using that bat, Smokey could use it with the best of them. Al Smith was play for anybody, anytime, every day if he would have had to. But being a right-handed hitter and Smokey being a left-handed hitter, they platooned pretty much the whole year. I just sat back and encouraged them and didn't say a word to them because they were playing so good. We only had about 9-10 players that played every day, and the rest of us just sat there. And boy, we was good cheerleaders, so I know that.
Well, I'd like to just go through their lineup a little bit. At first, they were platooning Dick Stewart and Rocky Nelson. What could you tell us about those fellas?
Dick Stewart, he could hit a ball. He was strong. And he that's all he wanted to do was hit the baseball, and he could hit it the wrong way. Rocky Nelson, he was my roommate.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he could, I tell you what, Rocky could talk, chew tobacco, smoke a cigar, play poker, watch television, and beat you in all of them. He could do it all. He never had a drink. I don't think he ever drank in his life. And he was funny, a funny roommate. He was really a good guy to have around because he'd give you a lot of laughs.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. I heard, or I've read about Dick Stewart being somewhat defensively weak. They called him Dr. Strangeglove. Is that true?
Oh, very good. I saw Haddix make a move to first base, and the ball went right out by Stewart. He didn't even see it. And by the time Stewart found the ball down the right field line, the runner was already on third base. Yeah, he forgot what the glove was used for. Sometimes those gloves protect your hand, but Stewart didn't have to worry about that.
Oh, boy. So, Rocky, he hit 300 that year, and it seemed like he was... just what they needed in that situation.
Oh, yes. Everybody forgot about the home run he hit the first inning of the World Series, too.
Oh, sure.
Ahead, yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned Hal Smith. Hal Smith, is his home run really,
Yeah, he would have been a hero, before you do it, Covetti hustled like hell on an infield base hit, beat Jim Colts the first base, and ninth inning in, and guy by the name of Mazeroski. Every time I see him, every 5 years, we have a reunion every 5 years, the Pirates bring us back. And I tell Maz, you caused all this trouble bringing us back here. And it couldn't happen to a nicer guy in baseball. For a guy to win the World Series, he played every game, never said a word. Him and Dick Grove knew how to play the short and second base. They was great, up the middle, straight. And for a guy that didn't get much publicity that year, and a great ball player was Mazeroski. That's why God gave him the talent to hit the home run to win it for us. Now, it could happen to a nicer guy, more deserving guy, that played every day and didn't say a word. And Dick Grote, he couldn't run, and he couldn't throw very good. But God damn it, every ball that hit his glove, he'd throw the ball on first base. They'd be stopping games nowadays for instant replay with Grote playing shortstop, because he knew how strong his arm was. He knew where the runner was and everything. He'd get him by a half a step every time at first base. And he could really, he knew the game of baseball really good.
Oh, yeah, Dick Grote was a wonderful player. When we talk about Maz's fielding, how would you describe his ability at second base?
Well, the ball, I don't know if he caught the ball in his glove or not. Sometimes I think he caught it in his bare hand or threw it. He had the quickest hands around second base, and I never saw him ever get knocked out of second base by a slider. He could jump, spread his legs apart. Somehow he was really quick with his feet and hands, and he was unbelievable in the field. And he used such a small glove. It was amazing what he did at second base.
So we talked about Dick Grote, too. And when he got injured, Dick Schofield really did a good job of filling in for him.
Oh, he did an unbelievable job. Schofield did an unbelievable job, yes. And I can remember the last the last game of the season that year before the World Series. Dick Grote played shortstop, and he got on second base. Let's see how it was that again. Anyhow, he got on second base, they took time out, and I ran for him. I took him in, I ran for him, and I thought they was clapping for me for being a pinch runner. Clapping for Grote. it was really fun.
Now, tell us a little bit about Don Hoke, who was at third base.
He was ex-Marine, and boy, you better not start arguing or fighting. He'd be right in the middle of it. He was the most competitive guy I've ever played with. He wanted to win. He had one thing in his mind, to win, and he knew how to win, and he fought for everything. Every inch of the way. He was an ex-Marine, the one who were all safe, guys like him in service. Mm. But he was a great guy. I loved him, and he married the singer, of course, her name, Jill.
Jill Corey.
Jill Corey. I enjoyed every day that he played, and never missed a game.
Boy, he died young. It was a tragic thing with him. He died.
The Tiger was a. It was amazing how he passed away.
He was chasing somebody that. He was in a car chase of some kind, as I recall.
Yes, stole the car.
Yeah.
So he got in the car, chased him down with his old car, died in the car, something like that. Yeah. It was an unbelievable story. Yeah. The Tiger was a tough competitor.
So did Bob Prince, did he give you a nickname?
He might not even know who I was, but I know one thing. He could make a game exciting anyhow. And he was a great guy. You talk about a guy being funny. He was funny. He wore all those crazy outfits and he had a great voice. And, they tell me that he was involved in the Masters home run, huh?
No, he was away.
I think he was coming down to get the first interview with him before he knew Masters was going to hit it, I guess. I don't know what happened.
Yeah. Boy, I'll tell you, I couldn't believe when he was let go from the Pirates organization.
Yeah, him and Jim Woods, they was a good pair.
They were, yeah. So in the outfield, we have... Bob Skinner was in left field.
The dog.
is that what his nickname was?
Yeah, the dog. He ran like a dog, you know. He was bobbing all the time. He could swing that bat to the left side. And he played a strong left field for us, and that's why a lot of us didn't get a chance to play. These guys are too good. They didn't need our talent anyhow right then. And
Bob, did you play other positions other than catcher? Well, any?
Catcher's all I ever played, yeah. But Skinner was a good left-handed hitter, and he had some pop in the bat, and he could run better than you thought he could. He ran with his head bobbing and everything else. The nickname Dog got him. And he became an everyday left fielder, him and Cimoli. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Tell us a little bit about Gino Cimoli.
He was a dago from California, and you're talking about a guy who was funny. He was funny. He had those old sayings like, "What, the Yankees broke all the records, but we won the World Series," things like that. Cimoli was a good outfielder. He could go catch a ball any place, and he got a big face hit for us in the World Series. Mm-hmm. And he was all right. He could play on my ball club.
Well, he did. So then comes to center field with Bill Verdon. They called him the Quail.
The Quail. Yeah. Well, I seen him climb the fence that stone wall, brick wall, and poor field, put his cleats in the vines and catch balls way above his head. He could go get a ball as quiet and as easy as anybody, but when he had to make a great catch, he was there. Any ball that was hit the center field, you could wrap it up, head for the barn because it was all over there. Bill Verdon was really a good leadoff hitter, and